This Sunday Show with EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum, an interactive journey that shows how a small island made a big impact on the world. EPICCHQ.com.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to the Sunday Show. And I'm delighted to be joined this evening by a very special guest, Niall Breslin. Niall, it's a pleasure to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year too. How are you getting on?
I'm great, thanks. Now, Niall, you're a musician, you played rugby, you write books, you're an award-winning podcaster. Wow, like a man of many, many talents.
Yeah, I think personally I never like put myself in a box, and I don't do it to other people, so I don't do it to myself. So I luckily, I mean, I don't have any responsibilities, so I have the freedom to go off and make decisions and do different careers. And it's something I massively value and that I'm able to do, and I do a lot of them. And this time next year I might be doing something else.
Yeah, I know. I remember watching you on The Voice. You were great as well. What's really interesting, Niall, is your journey. I suppose if we can go back and talk a little bit first, I suppose, about just your early childhood. I think your family of five, you played GA, you played rugby, of course, the Blizzards, musician, I mean, and then the whole journey in mental health, which, I mean, is really amazing, I think, with your podcast, what you're doing today.
Yeah, my journey was quite a normal one for most people. I was born in Dublin, I was born in Blanchardstown, and my dad was in the army, so he got stationed down in Mullingar, and we moved down to Mullingar and had a pretty normal kind of army officer childhood, family. And I moved to Israel when I was 13, and that's when things kind of shifted within me. When 13-year-old is a strange time anyway, with puberty and all the other stuff that comes on with it and that change in life. But we moved to Israel, and Dad was there with the United Nations, and things went fairly horribly wrong at that point. There was what we now refer to as a 9-day war started there between Hezbollah and the IDF, and we were in the middle of it. So kind of something clicked within me. That kind of safety thing that I'd felt as a child was gone. And then I kind of, since that day, since I came back from Israel, I kind of dealt with what I didn't realise were panic attacks for most of my life, and kind of very hidden and repressed anxiety problems. But on the outskirts of all that, I was captain of my school football team. I was playing provincial rugby. I was in a band. I have amazing parents. But there was this really difficult silent part of me that I wasn't functioning. And then Kurt Cobain died. I remember Kurt Cobain dying, and that had probably the biggest impact on me, because I was obsessed with them. And I asked the teacher in my class what happened to him, and the teacher screamed in my face and called him a coward. So that was the type of education I was getting in the 90s around mental health. So of course I'm not going to start talking about what I think is going on for me when I have teachers saying stuff like that. And that was kind of the driving force behind my work in education and going back and setting up the charity and making sure that we give young people the education to navigate their emotions. And that is my biggest focus. That's my PhD focus. That is the focus of Lust for Life, the charity. We're now in 1,500 primary schools. I don't want to see young kids learn the way I learned around mental health.
When you came to playing for Leinster, and then, of course, you're on a stage there, and then the Blizzards, you're on a stage there. How was that for you? I mean, was that something that was easy?
I didn't have social anxiety. People have this very quick, broad strokes to talking about mental health, that they're all the same thing. Actually, I weirdly felt comfortable on stage or on a pitch. That's where I felt where I could actually not think. You didn't have time, no time to think on stage. You do not have time to think on a rugby pitch. You're playing almost subconsciously. You're just playing through, things move so fast. It's when I had time to myself, that's when my head would go rogue, and I didn't know how to manage those. I didn't manage the thoughts. I didn't know what to do with those thoughts, and then that affected my sleep and all that stuff. So people often say that to me, you're very comfortable on stage. That's where I'm most comfortable. I've worked hard to be comfortable on stage. As a musician, people don't realise that people put years upon years in crafting their guitar, their piano, their vocal, whatever it might be, to be able to stand on stage with confidence and perform to a crowd. So I put that work in, and I was very, very comfortable there.
Yeah. And I mean, and the music, I mean, it was a really successful band. I mean, they were hugely popular.
Yeah. And like, we weirdly started as, I was playing rugby at the time, and I remember our first ever show, I broke my nose. I was playing against Munster for Leinster on the Friday night down in Musgrave Park in Cork, and I got an awful kick in the face and broke my nose and kind of two black eyes. But we had a gig the next day, and I hadn't told the Leinster lads I was in a band. I thought they'd just absolutely run riot, and I had to go on stage the next day in the stables in Mullingar with the Blizzards with two black eyes and a broken nose. And the crowd looked at this 6'6", shaved head, broken faced guy on stage, and they clapped for the whole show because they were terrified of me, I'd say, more than anything. But I kind of knew at that point, I don't want to play rugby anymore. This is what I want to do with my life. Sport is what I did and music is what I am. It's every part of my body is, my mum's a music teacher. I was surrounded by music. My brother's a music producer. It's all I've ever known. And no one really in my house was an athlete. My dad played a bit of sport, but really music was where it's at. And the band took off. We were signed to Universal, ended up supporting AC/DC, Oasis, mad shows. We played, I was lucky enough to play Slane 3 times. We had a brilliant time, but I wasn't doing well and kind of started struggling again. And it was just this type of, my rugby career, I retired due to my head, and then the band kind of went belly up. Not belly up, but we had other priorities. The lads had children. We weren't making a lot of money, really. People have this perception that if you're on the radio, you're making money, and it is just simply not true. And you certainly might be able to have a bit of crack and go out on your Friday nights, but you ain't going to raise a family on it. That's what happened with the Blizzards, and then I ended up moving to London as a songwriter.
And, I mean, of course, you talk about the mental health. I mean, your book and the Jeffrey character, I mean, that was really interesting. What was the kind of inspiration for that? You started deciding, I suppose, that you wanted to put this down on paper.
Yeah, well, Jeffrey is what I called my depression. And this was 12 years ago. Now, it's important to point out, I wrote on a piece of paper when I decided to publicly speak about my mental health. And I told my family I'd lose my job and I'd probably have to leave the country, because that's just what I thought, because no one was really saying anything. And I was so tired of it, because I knew friends of mine were struggling. I knew other people close to me were struggling. I knew people in my community were struggling. And I didn't understand why we were so quiet about it. And it really annoyed me. And then I started to believe I wasn't being honest with myself at all. And that was causing an awful lot of issues with my mental health. And then I said, I need to be honest about this. I was on a big TV show. I knew young people were watching the show. I knew I had an opportunity to kind of go, lads, this is not something we need to repress or hide. It's something that a lot of humans deal with. And that's why I named him Jeffrey. I sat down one day and I said, Jeffrey, listen, this is not working for either of us. And we need to find a way to make this work for both of us. And it was that simple. And that's when I started actively looking for proper help. And it was a long road back, a lot of work, because you're dealing with stuff you've avoided for 15 years. It's not like sometimes people paint this picture that it's a really easy, lovely journey, but it isn't. It's a really challenging one, and it's a really important one. And I call it the scenic route. Crap roads, terrible grass growing in the middle of it, hills, but the view is worth it. When you get there, the view is worth it. You see the world in a different way. And what's important for me to say here is that anyone who comes on a radio show, anyone who stands on stage and says that they've all this figured out, they're lying to you. Nobody has. We are all kind of, some people know what they're doing to a point, but really we're all just kind of navigating the chaos of the world in our own ways. And I think there's something liberating about that, and there's something heartwarming about that we don't need to answer everything. And I don't need to be cured. I just need to be able to cope and enjoy the good stuff when it comes and navigate the bad stuff when it comes.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, it's so good to hear you speaking like that, because I think a lot of people here, I think a lot of us growing up, even in the 80s and the 90s, there was a lot of reasons, I suppose, we were in a different country, there was a lot of shame. And you talk about something very interesting on your show as well, about post-colonial trauma and a lot of things, very interesting interviews you've done about people that, Holocaust victims, where their kids actually, they checked levels of cortisol and found that they were actually stressed. It was almost like hereditary in a way, and that's fascinating.
It is fascinating, and it's something. So the focus of my PhD is 150 years of intervention within mental health, where you're like looking at what we've done over the years in this country. Now, by 1950, Ireland had the highest level of people in psychiatric hospitals in the world, more than Russia. Like, this is where we were at. We loved locking people up in this country. We locked them up if they didn't conform and it didn't fit in. And after we gained independence, we had to prove to the Brits that we wouldn't fall apart. So anybody who didn't conform were just thrown into institutions or into industrial schools and then the mother and baby homes. This is what we did. And when it comes to mental health has always been, for me, the line between normal and abnormal. And I always say to people, who gets to define what normal actually is? And that's really important for me to understand. But when you look at things like Ireland's history, as much as I adore this country, I'm a very proud Irishman. I adore it. I'm very lucky to be from here. We have a dark past. And people will go, well, sure, what that's got to do with me? Sure, that, geez, I wasn't around. You weren't around. But there's a baton that gets passed on, not just from a hereditary point of view, from an actual environmental point of view, you might have that father who was very cold because his father was cold, or abusive because he'd lived through a famine and then went from a famine into severe poverty and then civil war and then all the other stuff that came with it. And then that father said to the next father, was really cold and difficult with him, and it just gets passed on biologically and physiologically and from an environment point of view. And that's the intergenerational trauma that we talk about. And what's happening now is this generation are starting to drop the baton and going, actually, no, we're going to address this stuff and talk about it. And they're being labelled snowflakes because we love labels. Jesus, we love putting labels on people. Generation Z, X. We love dividing people as much as we can. At a time when we need to figure out how we come together, we shouldn't be dividing people. And I think that's ultimately what I'm trying to do in my work, is to say to people, we've had a difficult past. You mightn't think it has any impact on you or your children now, but it does. And the best way to deal with it is through conversation, is through exploration, is to understand this stuff and saying to our kids, right, lads, see the stuff we used to hide and not talk about, it ain't going to happen with you. And let's give them the tools, let's do it properly. And the one thing I will say, Ireland has huge problems with its health system. We know that. Fundamentally, its mental health system is very, very broken. And it's a big focus of my research as well. But what we do have is a world-class education system, world-class teachers. Let's develop those programs, but let's make it work for teachers too, because we can't just lob more stuff on them. I see it every day. They have too much to be doing. So we got to make this work. We got to resource them properly, and we got to think about this in a much more proactive way. And I'll finish on this. Population of 5 million, the size of Manchester, tell me we can't be world leaders at youth mental health in this country. That's what I believe. I believe we're a case study for it, and I think we could prove to the rest of the world how to do it. And that's the focus of my research.
But I think it's very interesting. You're a bit of a pioneer in that. What you're saying there, I think, is very healing when I'm listening to you about generational and how there was a lot of problems with, alcohol in this country, and we had a lot of problems, of course, with male suicide and things being linked economically and stuff. But it's quite healing to know that it's almost sort of handed down and it's not your fault.
And I think it's important. We all have to take responsibility too. So there's a middle ground, I always say. But the problem with, the wellness industry is a $7 trillion industry. It's in the business of telling you that it's up to you to deal with all your stuff. You have to be more resilient. You need to do more yoga. You need to take magnesium. You need to do all these things. And yes, you do to a point, but there's also another middle point where we got to create places where it feels safe, where we have our needs met, where you're not, you look at Dublin now and people not being able to pay rent, living with seven people they don't know, and then the wellness industry telling them just to do yoga. Yoga's not their problem. What their problem is security. What their problem is self-worth, to believe that I'm working really hard and I should be able to live a life that's enjoyable and not terrified whether I can pay rent each month in the richest country in Europe. So my work has evolved into going, actually, it's a 50-50, I think, thing. Take responsibility for yourself, but also you need to have the supports in place. If you decide that you want to be really healthy and well, that there's no obstacles to that for you. And that's the belief I have around mental health, that it is as much political as it is about the person.
And that is very interesting because, there isn't anything as worrying for anyone, I guess, as not being able to pay mortgages and bills. And we had Ricky Tomlinson on here a few weeks ago chatting about the UK, and he said, how did they come to this? And
how did
it's amazing, isn't it, to think like that in this day and age that we're supposed to be evolving, and yet
we're not evolving. And it's really important to highlight this, that people will say that COVID caused this. COVID exposed this. That's the difference. COVID has shown us that the way we actually do business as governments right now focuses far too much on economics and on growth, 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 growth. That's all you hear. I interviewed Pascal on the podcast, and my first question was do you think by your blinding desire for wealth as a country, you've dropped the ball on our social problems? And we have. And it's this what we refer to as neoliberalism, which is the market fixes everything. It doesn't. The market will not fix everything, because if you tap into human psychology, they call it the unquenchable thirst. People don't want to be wealthy. They want to be powerful. And this is what happens with neoliberalism when you leave, the housing market in Dublin over to private enterprises. They're not going to reduce rent. They're not going to. Well, why would they? Their only priority is profit. And countries, I have a degree in economics, and it's a very blunt instrument on which to judge a society. So I've realized this stuff, and I kind of look back in the way I used to talk about mental health, and I want to punch myself in the face, because I was telling people, just go out and exercise, and But that's the thing about the ego. You need to not hold on to it too tightly, and you need to let your thinking evolve. And that's what I've done. And now I'm looking at a country where I have friends who've two children that they can't afford to get them taken care of, two good jobs, and they can't get a mortgage. Some of them can't pay rent. Some of them are literally budgeting on whether they can eat.
Yeah, I mean, we can't all move to Sweden, right?
No,
we can't. Childcare is free. Yeah, no, but it's totally right what you're saying.
But yeah, we have full employment and a GDP that's the envy of Europe. But what's it worth?
It doesn't trickle down. Do you think the social model, I mean, is broken? Because it seems to me, you grow up, you go to college, you get a job, you get a mortgage, you pay all this money off, you're at the mercy of interest rates and all this. And you were saying there about capitalism and the private sector. And do you think yourself that we're going to have to change? I mean, going forward, I'm not sure if we have the political will here, but it seems to me that nothing feels right.
So I always am wary of using words like broken, because it can be very rejecting for people, dejecting for people, and they go, oh my God, there are so much brilliant parts of this society that function so well, and we have to be wary of that.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of work that I do is how do we actually shift our focus to look at why that works well and why that doesn't work well. And now, I'm not an expert in housing. I'm not an expert in many other areas. I'm researching heavily the area of health, and I've a fairly strong understanding of it. But the problem is we silo these problems. We go, housing's over there, health is over there, addiction is here. They're all part of the same situation. And for example, you look at addiction. I've never met anyone with an addiction who wants one. We got to rethink how we look at stuff. And people always say the opposite of capitalism is socialism. It's not. They call this thing called capitalist realism, which is the idea that people believe there's no other option to capitalism. There's a thing called the third way, which is essentially not unlike what we see in Nordic countries and social democracies, that you look at things like early prevention in terms of health, you put a lot of your budget into early prevention, you look at things like housing, you look at all these different areas in education, and you make everything accessible for people. The thing that breaks my heart a little bit about Ireland, and I understand this, I said it to Pascal Donoghue in the podcast, when I look at our history and you study our history, you realise that Ireland was so poor and poverty was the prevailing wind that absolutely was so destructive in Ireland. And I don't think anyone growing up in Ireland now has any idea how bad it was in terms of poverty. And when we went from colonialism, and then when the British, it was barbaric stuff that was happening here, and people were so poor they were putting their children into institutions because they just couldn't afford to feed them. And I understand that a country that has lived through that poverty wants to be wealthy and wants the desire to be wealthy and secure, I get. And I think Ireland has done a pretty good job in getting there. But we've missed too many things. We've missed, a society isn't built on that alone. And I think that's what I worry about. I worry about equality massively. I worry about access. We have to think wider around the word equality and what it means. And to me, equality is about equity, is about giving people opportunity to, even education's a prime example like that. You look at how education is actually developed and built. Lynn Rowan talks about this a lot. And we see people who are wealthy-ish in the same industries because their parents can afford to support them for a period of time. They can put them through third level institutions. They can, for example, what parent who's just about paying their rent can afford to send their child to college in Dublin, who now has to pay a thousand euro a month rent? Yeah. And the rest.
Yeah, it's just like, it's soul destroying.
It writes off a lot of people. People go, I'm sorry, you can't go to college. I cannot pay for that. And then you start to pull the tread even further, and you look at the average cost of rent in Dublin is 2,200 euro. That's the starting wage for a teacher now. So what, people are going, we can't get teachers. Where are all the teachers gone? They can't afford to be here. So they're going to Dubai. They're going to Australia. Who could blame them? So the problem is, when you drop the ball on these social issues, they have real, real consequences on how our society functions. In our education, in our health, we're losing doctors, we're losing nurses, because they can't afford to live here. And that's sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that you mentioned the Nordic there. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Finland, Sweden, Denmark. I mean, the mayor of Helsinki was talking recently where they've eliminated homelessness because they made a determination. They gave every homeless person their own little property for life. There you go. And there was none of this going around. And then they looked after them. If they had addiction, if they had problems, it wasn't just a once-off sort of thing. And then they subsidise student accommodation as well, and they do a lot of stuff, which is very enlightened.
It's enlightened.
So you wonder why can't we just copy that?
Because the thing, if you want to understand how a society works, you've got to look at the power dynamics within that society. Who pulls the strings in that society? Who pulls the string? Who makes the decisions? Because unfortunately right now, in many situations, I don't believe it is our government that makes the decisions in a lot of what we do. I believe that when you have such powerful organisations and corporate companies, they have a huge sway in decision-making processes. And there's your power dynamic. And in Finland, they don't really let that happen. But Mike Ryan, the amazing Mike Ryan of the World Health Organization, I had him on the podcast, and he spoke about chatting to the Prime Minister in Finland about this. And they said the reason they did that was because the most dangerous person in any society is the person with nothing left to lose. And Finland has something to lose. And that is the type of thinking. We aren't solving the mental health issue by focusing on the health system alone. We just aren't. That's a plaster and a bullet wound. A lot of people are struggling because of their environmental situation, their financial situation. And then what happens is, if for long enough you're struggling to pay your rent, you start to question your self-worth. You start to go, what am I doing with my life? How can I not pay rent? I've worked hard, I've done everything, and my mates are fine. And that creeps in on you. And then throw into the equation then a relationship issue maybe, or something else. Mm. It can feel like the world is overwhelming for you. And what I say to those people is, it is overwhelming. And what I struggle with then is, then we're told just to be more resilient. I'm like, we are the very definition of resilience. We just went through a global pandemic. Nobody enjoyed it, but we got on our feet and we got going again. That's what it is. Resilience isn't avoiding this stuff. And we need to stop telling people to be more resilient, who are like superheroes, who are just trying to get through their day. And we need to provide them with the supports that they need in the wealthiest country in Europe. And that's economics that trickles down. And as I said, that's not going to be solved overnight. People are going, who's going to do that? Which political party is going to do that? People are going Sinn Féin or the Party for Change. I don't know. I haven't seen anything in their mental health manifestos that makes me believe they understand this any more than Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil. I really haven't. So this needs a paradigm shift in how you think about mental health. It doesn't need a new political party, because they all relatively think the same about it. They don't understand it. They really don't. They haven't taken the time to understand mental health because it scares them.
Yeah, and I mean, what's very interesting, I remember Nelson Mandela saying a few years ago that everybody deserved two things, a job and a roof over your head. And if you put those things in place, the rest, it does tend to make a happier place.
It's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but the other thing you need in place is a sense of purpose. A sense of purpose is really important. You need your security, you need to feel safe, you need to feel like there's somebody has your back. You need that, and you need that emotional scaffolding, I call it. But you do need a sense of purpose too. And for some people, that might be their job, it might be whatever they are, it might be their children, whatever it is. But something that makes you realise there's more to the world than you. And that's important. And in Ireland, luckily enough, a lot of people do have senses of purpose. And this is really important for me to say. The reason I'm passionate about this is because this country, I believe Irish people believe in one thing above all other things. That's fairness. They believe in fairness.
Yeah, hear, hear.
We always have. And I think the reason people are passionate about this isn't because they like giving out and throwing stones at a problem. It's because it can be better than this, and so much better. And when it is, I think we'll understand that. And I am not a problem admiration society. All my work is focused on what can I do to help. And that's what our charity has said. We're in 1,500 primary schools. Our programs are free. No cost to primary schools. 20% of our schools are debt schools. We are trying to solve, and now we've moved into secondary school systems. My passion is to provide a complete educational solution for mental health from first class to leaving cert. A coherent program. And the other thing that's important that children understand is that part of our program is to say that life is hard sometimes.
Yeah.
It is difficult. I mean, you can't be protected from it all the time.
I know. I mean, in school, if you were bullied, like, at least you went home and you didn't have social media. Like, now it's relentless, isn't it? You don't have anywhere that's respite at all, it seems.
It's this, and that's when you get into the physiology of mental health. What happens is the brain perceives threat, and it doesn't know the difference between real and perceived threat. It just doesn't. So back when our brain was being built, essentially, and evolving, it was evolving for physical danger. That's how it works, and it's unbelievable at its job. That's how it functions. But now most of our threats are emotional. You can't see them, and that's really overwhelming. Because
And I think overwhelming is the I think a lot of people are feeling that, aren't they? Like just kind of saturation.
But also, I think, to be fair to the media, they do enjoy tapping into that fear a little bit as well. And I won't mention this, the news station, but I every time I open it, the word nuclear is there. It is, and yes, the world is in a strange place right now.
It's the fear factor element, of course.
During COVID, for example, I'll give you an example of COVID. COVID was as much, if not more, a psychological pandemic. It affected people psychologically more than it did. And I lost my uncle to COVID very quickly. So, I mean, I have very real consequences to what COVID was. But it was very psychological. And I was watching Neffet and Tony Hoolan, and not once was there a psychologist in that committee saying to us, listen, lads, I know this is overwhelming. When they were telling my parents that they had to cocoon and couldn't leave their home, who already felt vulnerable, nobody's saying to them, lads. And then they're going, well, this is public health. And I says, is psychology not public health? So for me, I look at the COVID and whatever your opinion of it, I see huge psychological consequences that haven't even began to be processed. And it also highlighted to me that I believe a lot of how we look at health in this country doesn't think about mental health. It just doesn't register. It is very much public health was sickness, not sickness. That was it. There was no talk about what stress does to somebody. And I have another, unfortunately, very close family members who died of cancer because they never got to go to hospital because they were terrified to go. So these are real consequences of what we went through. And I see the impact that's had on my family. And I say there's hundreds of thousands of families that dealt with that. So I think it was a real indication to me to how we look at the human condition. And I think we focus a lot on physical health, which is good, very little on mental health. And I think now we realise that come out of
consequence. And I think that's what's so amazing. And I think when you talk and people, I think people are realizing now more and more. I mean, I didn't know. I was watching there in 22, the three daddies who walked all for 300 miles in Britain for their three daughters that had committed suicide. Mm. And the biggest killer for under 35 in the UK in 22 was suicide. I mean, I was completely shocked.
The highest chance of death.
Unbelievable.
For male and female. And I don't quite, we look at things like masculinity and the masculinity crisis. I hate words like that, and I hate the toxic masculinity stuff. These are just labels that we use, and these labels divide. That's all they do. And there's nobody bringing people together, and there's no positive male role models that are being given. Like what happens with social media, where most young people engage, is they reward division. They reward generally bad behavior because that's what gets engagement. And young men, we need to reach out to them now, and we need to actually bring them together and let them understand that, like, these are the guys who are going to drop the baton that we've been passing on and on and on and on. And yeah, I look at, we can really focus on suicide a lot, but I focus a lot on preventative measures. We need to stop people getting to that point of crisis. That's where our budget should be going. That's where we should be spending our money. And right now we spend 6% of our health budget on mental health. And most of that 6% is spent completely ineffectively and completely on the wrong paradigm, which is generally just around a medical model. The medical model is important. It's part of the process. But right now in our health system, it's the only show in town. And a lot of people who've struggled through the pandemic, they're not depressed. They just need someone to support them and help them and make sense of what happened. That's what they need. But we're not giving them access to that. We're not giving them access to therapy, to psychological support. And if we are, it's 12 months or 24 months. It's just not good enough. And it's simple as that. And I think it's, as I said, this isn't rocket science. This can be fixed. This can be changed. It will take political will.
Well, it's absolutely great to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Sunday Show. My very special guest tonight, Niall Breslin. Niall, very interesting. I heard you talking about addiction, which I think is a huge problem for Ireland as well. And you talked about repressed and internalized pain that kind of led to a lot of addiction. And I think it's something, again, that people get medicated for. They go and they go to rehab and they do stuff, but they don't ever address the problem. And I think you have some very interesting ideas on that.
Yeah, the phrase we often use in the podcast is avoidance is the root of all disorder. And I think generally substances and behaviours can allow us avoid things that we don't want to deal with. Maybe the things are just too painful and something happened or something that you can't make sense of and it scares you and you just don't know what to do with it and you hold it inside all the time trying to make sense of it in your mind. And that can really eat you up. And if you have a drink or you take drugs or you gamble or whatever it ends up being and it takes it away for a window, it's a very good feeling. It is.
Dopamine.
And I mean, my own addiction was, unfortunately, sleeping pills. I was highly addicted to sleeping pills for a long period, heavily abusing them. But like, to me, it was like, I can sleep. I was getting, it was like the difference.
Yeah, just to try and turn off that constant noise. Yeah.
Like I was taking so many of them, I don't even remember falling asleep. I was just knocking myself out. And that was, in my head, the lesser two evils. And then I started to make sense of it in my head. And I was like, oh, sleep's really important. And you then convince yourself, But the other thing I convinced myself is that I would never, ever, ever fall into addiction because I was so aware of it. But addiction doesn't work like that. It waits till you have nothing left, no defences, and then it comes in, and before you know it, you find yourself trying to rob scripts off doctors' tables, you know? And that's the reality of addiction. And in Ireland, I actually have to be honest, I think people like Linoanne and other people are driving a sea change in how we think about addiction. And you look at things like vicious circles of poverty and inequality and how that feeds into addiction. And how that can absolutely be a huge part of it. And the first thing we tended to do in the past was just criminalize that. And it is a health issue. And this is the point. And then some people go, well, I know somebody. We all know somebody. We can all pick a point and pick somebody in an individual case that maybe pulls against what I'm saying here. But largely, the evidence and the statistics will show you that the people who find themselves heavily addicted to things like street drugs. And then you look in America, which is the thing. This is where it gets really upsetting, is that the biggest problem in America is painkiller addiction that were prescribed by healthcare professionals.
Yeah, well, driven if you look at the whole dope sick.
Dope sick, but that's only scratching the surface of the reality. Because that was endorsed, that was sanctioned by professionals. It was sanctioned by a pharmaceutical company, by health professionals. So the other thing we need to be able to do is create forums where we can talk about this and not be called conspiracy theorists. This is the problem. As soon as you question any medical science, you're seeing it. And I think it's important that we're able to talk about, especially in mental health, because when you look at the clinical outcomes of mental health since the 80s, they've completely flatlined. They haven't progressed in any shape or form. And we need to be able to say that. We need to go the way we are approaching medical mental health problems here is not functioning properly since institutionalization into the fact. And it's okay that we say that. And it's okay that we explore that, because when you look at the actual science, it backs that up. And that's why I think we need a paradigm shift in how we look at mental health and addiction. And as I said, when there's been sanctioned addiction, and what's happening in America is actually terrifying. If you've been in San Francisco anytime, it's one of the most harrowing things you will see. The richest city in America, with the homelessness and addiction and mental health issues on the street, because they closed institutions, they didn't find people any care, they drove this addiction epidemic, and there's people there. And if we're not careful, Dublin is sleepwalking straight into the same thing.
Yeah, and that fear of people, as you were saying earlier, they just feel they don't belong anymore. Yeah. They're lost because they don't feel they're not two cars and two houses or whatever the whole.
But do you know the thing to think about with addiction? I always think about it, and it's my own way of doing it. My sister's worked in addiction all her life as well. She works in Glasgow. She's worked with heroin addicts for years, alcoholism. And we all say the same thing. We see everybody who has a serious addiction, and we see them as an opportunity lost of somebody who. Not an opportunity lost that we can't. Like all these people who found themselves in addiction have so much to offer.
Yeah, and isn't it so rewarding? I mean, when you see the transformation in somebody that you and you said earlier, it's other thing you talk about as well. I mean, I was going to ask you. I mean, I often wonder, should we not all be in therapy or just as a sort of a?
I think we have to be important, because we have to be careful about this. Because firstly, just quickly on the addiction thing, is that the reason I say that, some of the most perspective-based thinkers I've ever met in my life are people who've come out of addiction. They've been there at the deepest, darkest place, and they have a very, very interesting view on life. And they're the people I find that I listen to the most, because I always say, sometimes you see more in the dark and you learn a lot about yourself and the way the world works and what matters when you're in that place. And so not only do I think we have to work harder at supporting people with addiction, we need to listen to people who've gone through it and understand it, because there's a lot to be learned there. Back to the idea of everybody getting therapy. I worry about this thing where we start to pathologicalize normal human stuff like stress, like you break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend and you're sad for a week.
Yeah.
And it feels
you're
bad.
Depressed.
And you're heartbroken. Are
it's
you
a normal
losing?
Thing.
Yeah. And are you, some people, everybody will benefit to a point of talking to somebody. Totally. But we need to also be careful. Not everybody needs therapy. We all work through things in our own way, and some of us are grand.
But when you had Brendan Harding chatting to you, and I mean, he talked about this and it was quite enlightening. He was like, and he's been through a lot of stuff as well. Depression is not an illness. It can be a way, if anyone has suffered from it, I've gone through my own bit with it as well. You do come out and you kind of become a bit enlightened. But as you said, it's not something that you just throw medication at.
It's a point of growth is what he says. And I think...
And people as well around you. But you were saying that people around you can be as good in your life.
I think the struggling thing in my own journey, I found it really difficult to be with anybody when I was like that. And I think Bruce Springsteen talked about that as well. I was And the reason I didn't want to be around anyone is I just didn't want anyone else to feel what I was feeling. I didn't want anyone else. I felt that I was influencing how they were feeling, and I just didn't want that. So it was easy for me just to completely pull away from everybody. And that's not the solution either. To be honest with you, some days it was. Some days it had to happen, and I batten down the hatches and I just deal with it. And those days, thank God, I haven't experienced in many years. And I can only, I suppose, hand on my heart, say I've gone through that twice. And it really does open your eyes to what matters in life. And people always, it's important to say depression isn't sadness. It isn't. Like, being sad is very normal. Like, feeling sad or bored because, or sad because you didn't get a promotion or you broke up with somebody, these are normal things we all experience in life, and we find ways to deal with them. Sometimes they become too intense and you do need to talk to someone. But we all have the tools to navigate that stuff. To me, the most difficult part of when I struggled at the height was I couldn't feel anything, good or bad. There was nothing. And it was difficult, and I could sleep. And yeah, and I look back and I don't call depression an illness. I just don't. Jim Carrey calls it deep rest. That's what the word comes from. Your body's trying to tell you something. It's trying to tell you something. It's like, I don't want to be this person, as Jim Carrey calls it, this avatar. I don't want to be this person. I need to let this person go. And in order to do that, I need this deep rest. And that's how I view it. And I think it's important that we have to be careful about using words like illness all the time.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about your multi-award-winning podcast, which I find very therapeutic, I have to say, and brilliantly produced. I love the way that you put everything together. There's so many podcasts out there now. When did you decide that was going to be your thing?
I was doing my master's at the time in UCD in mindfulness-based interventions, and I was like, this is really good stuff. I wish I could talk to people about this and take it out of the academic world and kind of try to make it accessible and understandable to people. And I said probably the best way for me to do it was podcasting, because I was actually getting really tired of, I was doing interviews about it and this stuff was getting taken out of context and put onto horrible cheap headlines and Facebook. And I was like, I don't want to be part of this world anymore. This stuff's too important to turn it into a cheap headline. Like I remember seeing a headline that's from an hour long interview saying that Niall Breslin says running cures depression. That annoyed me so much. It just annoyed me so that people were so lazy and clickbaity that they took something so important out of an hour long conversation and threw it into that. I said, you know what? I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm going to. And I think what podcasting does that social media has absolutely robbed the world of is gives context.
In an intimate context. Sort of a setting as well, isn't it?
And it's intimate and you're giving people context, you're giving them explanations, you're giving them time to think. And I wanted to translate that information into the podcast. And that's kind of what I did and started about 4.5 years ago. So still doing it.
And was the Olympia your big first sold out gig? I remember you had Adam Clayton on, I think. Brilliant guest you had. It was amazing.
He was brilliant. And he's an incredibly generous man with his heart and his soul. And he's very open about stuff. And he's very, there's a prime example of a man who came through an addiction and has a different view in the world and is able to talk about it. But it also just how happens to be the bass player in the biggest band in the world. That's what you're looking at. How close could we have been to losing Adam? You know what I mean? They're the fine lines. And he's lucky enough that he was in a position, I suppose, that he was able to get the right type of help to get him through it. But that's another prime example that there's many people who deserve just the same help he got that can't get it. And it's this type of stuff. So that he even talked about that himself. So yeah, it's people like him. I always say podcasting is not about big names. It's about big stories. I know he's a big name, but I have no interest in chatting to big names when they're hyper media trained and they don't want to, you can't disarm them in any way. And I understand that. They're just terrified that what they say will be taken out of context and put into a cheap headline on Facebook.
Yeah, and I mean, I love what you say about it's not about big names, it's about big stories.
It is.
Now, Eddie, the guy that you did an amazing podcast with in the Men Sheds, you won a fantastic award for that. That was real goosebump moment for me when I listened to it. Because he just spoke from his truth.
They all did that day. I live in Wicklow and I drove to Ballybrack to the Men's Sheds and I just took a crap mic and I sat between them all and I could feel it in them. They were all going to open up a little bit. And then Eddie just, so there's a prime example. Eddie talked about his abuse as a child, physical abuse of his father and what it did to him. And he goes, I'm never letting any child in my life go through what I went through. He's a prime example of the man who dropped the baton. I meant, no, not doing it. And now Eddie's family have utterly changed the trajectory of where their life will go because of his decision to make that. So that's that type of powerful stuff. And you can't pull that out of people. You got to create the environment where they feel safe to say that. And you also have to say to them, I said to them when I sat down, any of you say anything here, lads, that you're not comfortable with, you listen to this first and I don't put it in. It just doesn't stay in here because it's grand for me as a podcaster who does this every week, but I don't know what's going on in their family or Or other stuff. So these are the things you think about. There's a duty of care to what we do. We think about it very, very seriously every week. Whoever we bring on or talk on, we want to make sure that it's not quite what they say, it's the reaction to it. And I connect back in with the lads many times. They've come to the shows and they loved it. And now they're doing mad. They're doing amazing stuff. They're doing plays. They're writing books.
But you talk about there, you talk about purpose. Isn't that fantastic? I mean, amazing to turn that pain. And I remember Eddie talking about how his dad said to him, "You'll never be happy. Your marriage will never last." And he's like, 50 years I'm married now. That for me was almost a teary moment.
It was a teary moment, but it was a teary moment for all of us because he was there, he was shaking him when he was saying it, and it was cathartic for him as well. You could feel it off him.
And a place of trust. That was totally. The sheds, a place where he could say anything and he would never go anywhere.
Yeah, and the thing about it was like he as I said to all of them, say what you're comfortable with. And this is the point of the work that I'm trying to do, is that I'm trying to humanise this as possible, as much as I can. I'm trying to pull it away from the medicalization of everything and bring it down to the level of deep humanity of who we are. And everybody listening to this tonight, we all have our own little cracks. And Leonard Cohen puts it slightly more poetically. He says there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Sure, Ireland is full of crack now.
Yeah, and it's okay to admit that. And, you know, and I think it's important that everyone listening tonight probably carrying something. Some might be very heavy, some just might be a bit annoying. And the one thing I've learned through everything is when I'm sad, it never lasts. And when I'm happy, it never lasts. Life is not a straight line. It is not transient. And the only guarantee in life is change. And when you realize that and you don't hold on to any of this stuff too tightly, it's actually very liberating. And that ultimately is at the core of what we teach in mindfulness and Buddhism, is that change and impermanence is the only guarantee in life. And it's quite a nice thing to hold on to when you are feeling those difficult days and you're able to go, these ain't lasting.
Buddhism is very interesting, actually, because, I mean, I know it's non-theistic, of course, but it's just that meditation that is like switches off the noise, and that can be so great for you as well.
I think Buddhist people are very touchy about anything spiritual in Ireland because, I suppose, of our past with institutional religion, I suppose. I have no problem with religion at all or faith. I just have a problem with the institutions of the faith. Whereas Buddhism doesn't have a direct God, no deity. And that was the first thing I learned at the core of mindfulness, is this idea that most of our suffering, the first noble truth of Buddhism is suffering is an inevitable part of life. The second noble truth is that it comes from attachment to always having things the way you want them, never happens, and the aversion to never feeling bad, which is nonsense. And the way to nirvana is to let go of these attachments and these aversions, these attachments to always feeling happy or always wanting to be desired and rich. Let go of that and let go of the aversion of feeling difficult emotions. All of us feel them. And when they come, sit with them. And that's ultimately what we teach.
Now, the taking the podcast to the stage, of course, has been a huge success for you. Mm-hmm. You have some great stuff happening now in April. You have a tour all over Ireland. So you're going to be in Dunleary in Dublin here. You're going to be in the Civic Theatre in Talla, I think in early April. And then you're going all over the country.
So, yeah, I think the 12th of April, we're in Pavilion, which is a beautiful theatre in Dunleary. And then Civic Theatre, which I'm really looking forward to in Talla. That's on, when are we going to the Civic Theatre? It's the 23rd of April. And then one of the most beautiful places I think I've ever seen, the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan. Brand new place on the 27th. That's the last show of the tour. That is a one hell of a venue. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting up to Balbriggan for that.
Brilliant. Well, Niall, for anybody who's been listening this evening, where is a good place to go for anyone that wants to contact or get help or some of the courses?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for help or talking to people, there's amazing online supports like Prism Online Therapy is a really good online therapy support. There's the Samaritans. There is Pieta House is aware. We have great NGO services doing amazing things. There's My Mind. There's all these places. And also just reach out in your community. Talk to people in your community. As I always say, the one thing I've learned in this work is that 99% of people on planet Earth are lovely and sound. But for some reason, we only ever hear about the 1% of feckers all the time. And believe that. Get into your community. That's where a lot of your support will, even if it feels a bit scary for you, try it.
Wonderful. Niall Breslin, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this evening on The Sunday Show.
Sound lads, thanks a mil.